Well, I'm going to be praying for Alan that he have an audience with which he can share his comedy routines with, and hopefully that'll help him de-stress. So, there's been an amazing discovery made this past week. I'm going to share that briefly with you. But before I left on my trip last week, we have sound here, okay? Before I left on my trip last week, several of you came up after class and said, could you please say something about this Burgess Shale trip that Reasons to Believe is organizing and why you're doing it. Well, the Burgess Shale is one of only two places in the world where you get to see the fossils that are responsible for the development of the Cambrian Explosion. And we're going to be doing a conference up there on the Cambrian Explosion. I say we, it's going to be Fuzz Rod and myself. We'll both be addressing the fossil record and the context of the Cambrian Explosion, and especially Psalm 104 and in Genesis chapter 1. And the Cambrian Explosion is an event that happened 543 million years ago, where the planet went from nothing but unicellular life forms to suddenly every body plan that you can imagine for animal life all showed up at once. And there's two places in the world where you actually get to see the fossils of that amazing event. One is in the Yunnan province of China in a dry, dusty desert. The other one is in the Canadian Rockies in the middle of Yoho National Park. So I talked to Fuzz and said, which one would you like to go to? And we decided we'll go to the one in British Columbia, and actually for historical reasons, because that's the first place in the world that the Cambrian Explosion fossils were found. And for about 100 years, it was the only site where we had Cambrian Explosion fossils, but now there's a second site in China where you get to see a significant exposure. They've also found small sites in other parts of the world that show the Cambrian Explosion, but this site in British Columbia, the Burgess Shale, still ranks as a place where they've dug out the most fossils of the Cambrian Explosion. And most of the fossils are in the Smithsonian, not in British Columbia, because what happened is paleontologists basically rifled the place. But there's one site, there's actually 23 places in the Canadian Rockies where you get to see the Burgess Shale, but there's one site that's especially prolific, and it's a site that hasn't been rated. In fact, the University of Toronto is, as we speak, actively digging out the fossils from that site, and will be there. So you actually be able to see the researchers digging the fossils out. And you want to know where it is, we could have the lights off. This will help you see these photos a little bit better. Excuse me, let me pull it back. Basically, it's on the side of Mount Stephen. And Mount Stephen is a few miles from the Canadian Rockies Divide. That's the town of Field at the bottom. And roughly on that little ledge that you see up there is where the Cambrian Explosion fossils are present. And so people are asking me, how stiff of a hike is it to get up to those fossils? Well, you start walking in the town of Field, and you're basically going almost halfway up Mount Stephen. So it is a bit of an exercise. But when I went, people in their 80s had no trouble getting up there, mainly because you walk for 10 or 15 minutes and you listen to a 15 to 20 minute lecture from the geologist that is required to go with you. Say, why do you have to have a geologist with you? They want to make sure nobody steals the fossils. But what's also fun is you're basically walking up through this forest, and every 15 or 20 minutes, the geologist has you stop to rest because they don't want anybody to, you know, fail because of the altitude. But what happens is they stop at a place where they got a big, huge steel box. It's got a big lock on it. He's got the key, takes the lock out, and pulls out a bunch of the fossils that you're not going to see at the site. And so these are fossils that are different from what you're going to see. And he basically gives you, you know, a 15 to 20 minute lecture on the fossils in the can. You get to touch them. You get to photograph them. He puts them back in the can. He locks it back up. And you hike up for another 15 or 20 minutes to another can. And so that's how you get up there. And literally, it's very easy walk. You know, it's actually painfully slow if you like to hike.
What's the altitude gain? How high are you and then how much?
Well, you start at 5,000 feet and you end up at about 7,500 feet. So yeah, it's significant. I mean, it gives you some idea of what it's like. If you were to go up to the Sierra Hut on Mount Baldy, it's roughly like that. And for people in shape, you can do it in, 50 minutes. But hey, they take you nice and slow on this hike. And the geologists insist on being in front so nobody can go past them. You do walk very slowly. But this is kind of what you see on the way. So there's lots of pretty places to stop and to take photos. And that's... Well, when you actually get to the site, it's predominantly trilobites. And then you'll see shrimp-like creatures and segmented worms. But when they open up the cans, you get to see a lot of other... the Cambrian explosion is where you got 40-plus phyla, in other words, body plans of animal life that all show up at once. And so the cans, they show you things that you're not going to see at the site. But this is about halfway up along the trail, so that's what you get to see as you're walking through the forest. And this is where you begin to come to the edge of the forest. And that's Mount Stephen there. And by the way, if you want to climb Mount Stephen while you're there, you can do that. You just kind of run up that little ledge there to the top. And, people do that. But this is where you actually come out on the shale itself. And this is where the fossils start to get thick. In fact, that's a fossil right down there that shows up on that rock. And this is where it's really... This is just below the University of Toronto site. And at the site, they actually have it chained off where they're digging out the fossils. You'll actually see the pit. And they've got movie cameras all the way around it to make sure nobody goes across the chain fence. But you're able to lean over and take photos. But hey, just right in this very area there, you're literally forced to walk on the fossils that are so thick. And for example, you'll see several fossils on a single rock. So it's just everywhere.
Are you allowed to take them?
You're not allowed to take them. You can pick them up, you can photograph them, you can touch them, but you got to put them back. And as I say, there's a Canadian government geologist making sure that nothing goes in anybody's pocket. And, for good reason, they want to make sure this is a World Heritage Site. And so it's actually protected by the United Nations. And they want to make sure that, for generations to come, people will be able to see these fossils. For example, there's another site that my wife went to, and she said the entire area was picked free of fossils because they didn't get to it fast enough to protect it. But here you are in the fossil bed. And that's the view you got looking in the other direction. In fact, if you look across the way, what was really fun is Kathy and I split up because we wanted to see which of these two hikes was best. So I was on this part, and she was literally over there on that mountain looking at other fossils. And actually where she went is the place where they first found the Cambrian explosion fossils. Walcott's quarry is over there. You can actually see where Walcott, the Smithsonian, was digging out the fossils more than 100 years ago. So that's another view just from the fossil bed. So, hey, it's a spectacular view just to go up there, even if you're not interested in any of the fossils. So, and then it's about a 20 to 30 minute walk down. They let you go down as fast as you want. But going up, they do keep you at a nice slow pace. But, it's not just those of us who are Christians, who see this as a profound challenge to the macroevolutionary paradigm and see this as powerful evidence for God's supernatural intervention, like you see in Psalm 104. This is also the case. And what I did this past week is just collect for you from the scientific literature a few quotes from the leading evolutionary biologists who study the Cambrian explosion but take a non-theistic perspective. Here's one from Kevin Peterson. He says, and this is actually from his book, although the Cambrian explosion is of singular importance to our understanding of the history of life, it continues to defy explanation. And of course, what he means is it defies a materialistic or naturalistic explanation. And this is from Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker. And he says, the Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years, are the oldest ones in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. And he doesn't say this, but that would also apply to a lot of the vertebrate groups. Actually, when he wrote this, they hadn't discovered any vertebrates at the base of the Cambrian explosion, but they have now. And we find them already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. And by the way, that's page 229. Sorry, it got put there from his book, The Blind Watchmaker. So, remarkable concession from one of the world's most famous atheists. And this is from Gregory Ray. And I don't think Gregory Ray is an atheist. He hasn't really said where he comes from theologically. But he wrote this in the American Zoologist. The Cambrian explosion of body plans is perhaps the single most striking feature of the metazoan fossil record. The rapidity which phyla and classes appeared during the early Paleozoic, coupled with much lower rates of appearance for higher taxa since, poses an outstanding problem for macroevolution. And the point he's making is, you know, all these phyla and classes come into existence suddenly 543 million years ago. Very little has happened before. You only get three phyla showing up for the 3 billion years previously, and then afterwards not much happens either. And this is from BioEssays by a team led by Kevin Peterson. And they write that beginning some 555 million years ago, the Earth's biota changed in profound and fundamental ways, going from an essentially static system, billions of years in existence, to the one we find today, a dynamic and awesomely complex system whose origin seems to defy explanation. Part of the intrigue with the Cambrian explosion is that numerous animal phyla with very distinct body plans arrive on the scene in a geological blink of the eye. Now, that was the first page of the paper that they published, and on the second page, they say this: elucidating the materialistic basis of the Cambrian explosion has become more elusive, not less, the more we know about the event itself. And this is what Fuzz and I are going to be talking about at this conference, is just how over the past 30 years, the evidence for supernatural explanation has been getting progressively stronger and stronger. And as you can see, this is from a non-theist who makes kind of the negative statement that it's becoming more and more elusive to try to explain this from a naturalistic perspective. Incidentally, in the paper, what they do is they say, when you look at the fossils, they just suddenly show up all at once with no possible previous origin, just suddenly appear in the scene, and not much happens afterwards. Then they speculate in the paper as non-theists how this could have happened. And basically talk about an explosive eruption of microRNAs showing up in the these different creatures. But of course, they have no explanation for how to explain that explosion of microRNAs. Well, that's just a little preview of what we're going to be talking about in late August. And for those of you who can add an extra day, we're actually going to go to the Drumheller Dinosaur Museum. It's another place where we're actively digging out dinosaur bones. You know, that's a whole totally different era. So we're going to have a four-day conference where we talk about the event 543 million years ago. But for those who can add an extra day, and basically it's the day before, we're going to go to the world's best dinosaur museum. And it's spectacular. And basically look at events that are in the Jurassic and Cretaceous era. Anyway, we can have the lights back on. You can leave the lights off. Because what I want to do is talk to you about a really amazing discovery made by an amazing set of telescopes. And actually, those of you who work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory may be very well aware of this instrument. It's called the Very Long Baseline Array. And it's an array of 10 large radio telescopes distributed across the United States. And here's one of the 10 telescopes. It's in Mauna Kea, Hawaii. Now, the optical telescopes are on the top of that mountain off to the left, but a little bit below, they put up this radio telescope, and that's the farthest western arm of the Very Long Baseline Array. And the next farthest west is in the state of Washington. This is in Brewster, Washington, and in the midst of an apple orchard, they put up this radio telescope. This is one from California. This is the Owens Valley Radio Observatory, and that's this one on the left. And by the way, these telescopes are all dedicated just to the purpose of, for the Very Long Baseline Array. Over to the right there is a telescope that I used when I was doing research at Caltech, but this is the one on the left that's used in the array. And then this is the fourth telescope. It's at Kitt Peak in Arizona. And you can see the optical telescopes off to the left, but they've erected this telescope. And this is telescope number 5. It's in a place called Pi Town. I don't know how it ever got that name, but Pi Town, New Mexico. And also in New Mexico, they have number 6, which is in Los Alamos. And by the way, they typically are looking for high altitude sites, because that's where you get superior observations and places where you've got good weather. And Fort Davis, Texas is number 7. And then North Liberty, Iowa is number 8. And this one is in Hancock, New Jersey. And then the farthest eastern arm of the Very Long Baseline Array is in St. Croix, Virgin Islands. So off not to the bottom there is the 10th one. So these are literally 10 radio telescopes distributed over a baseline of a little bit less than 6,000 miles, running from Hawaii all the way to the Virgin Islands. Now, the reason why this array was put into place is to look at what are called water masers going around supergiant black holes in galaxies that are accessible to observations. You say, why are they doing that? Well, these water masers are bright point sources. It's basically gas clouds that are emitting collimated radio radiation at the wavelength for water, basically 1600 megahertz. And so, and therefore, it's a point source. You've got this highly collimated bright radiation coming out of a point source, and this is a water maser that's orbiting about the central black hole of a galaxy. And so what they're doing is that they're measuring the position of that maser with high accuracy. And what they're actually doing is observing these masers, and typically a galaxy will have several maser sources, our own galaxy does, and so there's these maser sources that are orbiting the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And so what they're trying to do is measure the positions of these masers with extremely high precision over a period of several years. And if you do that, you actually are able to measure the orbit of the maser about the central black hole. You say, why do they want to do that? They want to do that to measure a very accurate distance to the galaxy. Because, Newton's law tells us that the speed with which a body orbits a central body will depend on its distance from that body. So, for example, that explains why Venus orbits the Sun faster than the Earth and why Jupiter orbits the Sun slower than the Earth. It's all based on Newton's laws of motion. The farther you're away from the Sun, the longer it's going to take for you to orbit orbit the Sun. And so they're using the same principle. They're basically measuring the speed with which these masers orbit about the central black hole, which tells them the dimensions of the orbit. So they actually, that will tell them how big the orbit is in miles or meters or whatever you want. And so they know how big the orbit is. And then they use these telescopes to measure the angular diameter of the orbit. And so they're able to see where that maser is relative to the center of the galaxy. And so they get an angular measure of the orbit. They got an actual measure of how big the orbit is. and that tells them how far away it is. Is that all understandable, or do I need to break that down a little bit more? Yeah, it's basically parallax, but it's actually a trigonometric measure, because what you're doing is you're measuring the angle of the orbit, you know, the dimensions of the orbit. Remember your high school geometry? If you know the size of the base of an isosceles triangle, you know how far away the vertex of that is. How many of you remember that theorem? Okay, if you know the base of the triangle, and you know the angles of both sides, you know how far away the vertex is. Well, basically, that's what these astronomers are doing. They're using high school geometry theorems to determine how far away the galaxy is. Now, because they're using 10 telescopes stretched across over 5,000 miles, they're able to measure these angles with extremely high precision. In fact, it's this instrument that's able to measure it with the greatest possible precision. However, what's exciting about these papers that have just been published is they've actually commandeered other telescopes into the project. And this is called the high sensitivity array. So they use these 10 telescopes, which by themselves have quite a bit of collecting area. You know, each telescope is, 75, 80, 90 feet across. And then they bring in these other telescopes and also link them in. So, for example, the biggest one that they link in is in Puerto Rico, not far from the Virgin Islands, but it's a really big telescope. It's 1,000 feet across. Okay? Maybe some of you saw that James Bond movie where there was a fight between James Bond and some villain where they were actually running back and forth along that feed 600 feet above the ground, and you could see the telescope below. So I don't know how much they charged them to make the movie, but I think it probably supported a lot of astronomical research.
Don't hurt the telescope.
And you see this little road here? It actually goes underneath the telescope. So you can actually, you can access the telescope from underneath. Now, what they did is they found a parabolically shaped valley in Puerto Rico, and then they just kind of put this, they found a way to cheaply build this big reflecting area. However, it's not steerable. It just sits there. And so how they actually access significant fractions of the sky is they built a feed that moves back and forth. So that's why you see those three towers there. The three towers, because basically it takes radiation from the sky and focuses it up to that feed. But because they can move the feed around a significant degree, they can actually access about a 30-degree wide swath of the sky. And since the Earth is rotating, you actually get to look at a significant part of the sky. You can't see the whole sky with this object. It's limited to how far you can move the feed. But the big advantage is it can collect a lot of light because it's 1,000 feet in diameter. This is the world's largest telescope, radio telescope, and where you need high sensitivity. In other words, what they do is they take this telescope and link it in with the 10 to get greater sensitivity. It allows them to see much fainter objects. Because some of these masers in distant galaxies are not that bright. In order to be able to get to really far away galaxies, which is what you want to do to be able to measure the age of the universe, be able to measure the expansion rate, to test Big Bang cosmology, to find out what's going on with dark energy and the inflation event, you're going to need very high sensitivity. And so the papers I'm talking about, they took the 10 telescopes and also linked them with this 11th telescope. And just to make sure they got really high sensitivity, they also linked it with this telescope in Germany. This is the Eppelsberg telescope, and it's fully steerable. But it's 328 feet across. So it ranks as one of the two largest fully steerable radio telescopes in the world. And because it's 328 feet across, again, you can actually observe very faint objects. Now, the other nice thing about it is it's in Germany. So now you're looking at about almost 7,000 miles of a baseline. And then to get more sensitivity yet, they also link it with this telescope in West Virginia. This is the Green Bank Telescope. It's 328 feet across. rather interesting design. They didn't want the feed blocking any of the radiation, so they kind of put it off to the side so it actually reflects up at an angle to that feed that you see there. But notice what they're doing here. They're taking a 1,000-foot diameter telescope and two telescopes that are 328 feet in diameter, and so they can now combine them with these 10 telescopes and get really high sensitivity so they can observe weaker sources. And as the icing on the cake, they also link in these 27 82-foot diameter telescopes. This is called the Very Large Array. So you've got the very long baseline interferometer and also the Very Large Array. Now, this thing is only like 30 miles across as opposed to thousands of miles across, but you've got 27 telescopes. And therefore, you can get a lot of collecting area from these 27 telescopes. So the high sensitivity array is where they take these four largest collecting area telescopes and link them in with the 10. And with that, they can measure water masers at great distances. And that's the exciting thing about this paper just published in the Astrophysical Journal. They've actually been able to measure the distance through this high school geometry technique of a galaxy that's 470 million light years away. It was considered to be an impossible feat, but they made it happen because they were able to link these 14 different instruments all together. And so with the 14 instruments, they not only got extremely high resolution and be able to accurately measure these angles, but also able to see rather faint water masers. Because the best we've been able to do previous to that was measure directly the distance to a galaxy 162 million light years away. So they're basically extending it another factor three out into the galaxy. I mean, we're talking almost half a billion light years away. Now, which means that for the first time, we have an accurate direct measure of the expansion of the universe, expansion rate of the universe, and the age of the universe. Now, why is this so exciting to astronomers? Because this is free of assumptions. There are no systematic effects to worry about. It's all through direct measurements. Basically, the same technique you use when surveyors come out and measure how big your property is, for example. They use the same geometry theorems. And there's no assumptions. There's no instrumental effects. And so you're getting measurements that you know cannot be challenged in terms of saying, well, maybe there's an instrumental effect that's pushing the measurements one direction or the other direction. So this is an assumption-free measurement of the expansion rate of the universe. Now, I told you, almost 2 years ago, about this experiment where they hadn't linked in the high sensitivity for high sensitivity telescopes, just using the 10, and how they had measured directly a distance to a galaxy 162 million light years away. Well, what they've done is they've gone back to that galaxy and used the whole array, and moreover, they got three more years of measurements. The longer you measure the movement of these masers about the center central black hole of a galaxy, the more accurate measure you're going to get. And so what I told you a couple of years ago was that they came up with a very rough measure using this technique, but basically it was a proof that we can do it. So, you know, we've only looked at this these set of masers for a couple of years, and if we keep looking at these masers, we're going to get an accurate result. Well, they actually, what was fun too is they published both of these papers in the same issue of the Astrophysical Journal side by side, where they basically said, we now have an accurate measurement of the galaxy we told you about 3 years ago, but now we get another one that's three times farther away. We're actually able to measure the orbit. And by the way, what they say in these papers, this is just the beginning. This is the first time we've got an accurate measure using this direct technique, but as we continue to make observations, this is going to get better and better. And by the way, these 10 telescopes are dedicated to that particular project. Okay, now, what's even more exciting is that during the past 6 weeks, likewise, you've got two non-direct techniques for measuring the age of the universe and the expansion rate of the universe that are by far the most accurate. Now, they do have instrumental effects, but it's extremely precise what they've been able to do. And it's basically designed on measuring the size of the bumps in the cosmic background radiation. What's the cosmic background radiation? It's basically the relic radiation from the cosmic creation event. And you may recall back in 1992, they published the first map where they were able to show cold and light spots. This is COBE. This is the one that I talked about in the Crater in the Cosmos, where when the COBE map was published, COBE, it's an acronym. NASA loves acronyms. So, this is the first time that they'd actually seen the predicted temperature fluctuations in the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, something that had been predicted for over 20 years by the Big Bang creation model and was discovered in 1992. The leader of the COBE team says it's like looking at the face of God because we're actually seeing the details of the cosmic creation event. But as you can see there, it's not as detailed as you would like. On the other hand, they were able to look at these bumps. The red represents the hot spots. The blue represents the cold spots. The hot spots become future clusters of galaxies. The cold spots become the voids between the galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And the sizes of those bumps actually give you an estimate for the expansion rate of the universe and the age of the universe. However, that's one reason why the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe satellite was set up, because it says COBE showed that we're right about the Big Bang model and that the universe is roughly 14 or 15 billion years old, expanding at a certain rate, but it would be really nice to do this in some detail. And so they were able to send up a satellite that was able to measure it with much higher precision than what has been done before. And actually what you're seeing here is a just published 9-year data collection of the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. So this thing's been collecting data for 9 years. Now the principle in astronomy is the longer you look, the better answer you get. But there are diminishing returns. The improvement goes up with the square root of the time. So that means that with a 9-year map, you're going to get results that are 3 times better than a 1-year map. But you can see why they're not too interested in having this continue to make observations, because you get diminishing returns. But this is 9 years' worth of data, and indeed is 3 times better than their 1-year map. Just got published literally days ago, and based on this map, they were able to come up with the following cosmological numbers. And so for the Hubble constant, which is measuring the expansion rate of the universe, 69.3 plus or minus 1.2. And that 1.2 represents the second best measurement of the expansion rate of the universe, which translates into an age of the universe. Notice how accurate it is, 13.772 plus or minus 0.059. So we're now getting it down to the fourth place of the decimal. And that third figure there represents how much of the universe is made up of dark energy. Now, when the 1-year map came out, they said 73 or 74%. They're now saying it's 71.3% plus or minus 1%. Now, this is where all the excitement was, the fourth figure. Why is that so exciting? It tells us what kind of cosmic creation event we have. That's called the spectral index of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. Now, you say, what on earth does that number mean? Well, what it means is this. If that spectral index is 1 or greater than 1, then that means that there's no early inflationary event in the history of the universe. Now, if it's 0.95, it means that there is an inflation event, and it's described by the simplest model of cosmic inflation. If it's between 0.96 and 0.975, it's inflation, but it's not the simple inflation. It's the complicated inflation model, of which there's actually several types. And so this is basically telling us that the universe indeed has an inflationary event. Why? Because of how small this number is, 0.0080. Because if you want to be able to prove that, what that tells us, for example, well, let's see if we can figure it out here. That's what's called four standard deviations away from no inflation, which means we're 99.99% certain that an inflationary event happened. Now, for those of you that may not be up on this, an inflationary event is where you got the universe expanding from the cosmic creation event. And when the universe is 10 to the minus 34 seconds old, which is 1/10 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, it goes through a hyperfast expansion. Say, how fast? Thousands of times faster than the velocity of light. Universe goes from the size of about an electron to the size of a grapefruit in an extremely brief window of time. Yeah, you literally got to expand universe.
Grapefruit.
Well, it's because the inflationary episode is so incredibly brief, it only gets to the size of a grapefruit. But to get it from the size of a particle to the size of a grapefruit, you literally have to be expanding the universe at thousands of times, in fact, millions of times faster than the velocity of light. So it really is a hyperinflationary event. On the other hand, it's the only way you can have the universe thermally connected when it's billions of years old. And so inflation is actually something predicted by the biblical cosmic creation model, because the Bible predicts we're going to be living in a universe that can sustain advanced life. That requires a universe where you've got a certain distances between the galaxies, and that means you're going to need the universe to be a particular size at a particular epoch where advanced life is possible, but it's also got to be thermally connected. And the only way that's going to work is if you've got a hyperinflationary event when the universe is very young. And so what this does is actually prove that indeed the inflationary model is correct. Okay? But the real goal of astronomers now is to measure this number with sufficient precision that we can determine whether it's simple inflation or one of the more complex inflationary models. But we actually have a hint already in this 9-year data release that it's probably one of the more complex models, because if I can go back here, what astronomers saw in this 9-year data release is a slight anomaly. The anomaly is this. If it's simple inflation, we're going to expect that there's going to be homogeneity or isotropy in this map, where all these hot and cold spots are basically going to look the same everywhere. But notice when you look at this map, there seems to be a lot of hot stuff right here, much hotter than we see elsewhere in the map, and this seems to be a lot colder than everywhere else. So that's an anomaly that's been noted by the WMAP team. But it's an anomaly that would fit if indeed you have one of the more complicated inflation episodes taking place, rather than the simple one that's predicted by the number 0.95. However, this error bar is still way too large to distinguish between simple inflation and complex inflation. But it's certainly small enough to tell us that there must have been an inflationary event, although we'd like that to be more certain than 99.99%. And actually, that's what's coming up. There's another measurement that gives us even greater certainty. Say, what's this figure here? The fifth figure, I'll get to your question in a minute, but this fifth figure here actually determines the flatness of the universe. If it's exactly zero, it's perfectly flat, and if it's not flat, you're going to get a number that's greater or smaller than zero. But as you can see, it looks like it's very close to being flat. Yeah, your question?
From the grapefruit to what it is now, has it been expanding uniformly at the speed of light or something? Or?
It's been expanding at a faster and faster rate. That's actually a third paper I got here. There's a paper that determines how fast the universe has been expanding since the inflationary event. And it started off expanding less than the velocity of light and going slower and slower as time goes by. then it transitioned to going faster and faster. But for the past history of the universe, once you get past the inflationary event, it has throughout that whole period been less than the velocity of light, but not a whole lot less than the velocity of light. However, because of dark energy, that thing that makes up 71% of the universe, there will come a time shortly on an astronomical time scale, not tomorrow, but where the universe will expand at greater than the velocity of light. And that would be bad news for astronomers, because once that happens, you'll no longer be able to see the radiation of the cosmic creation event. To be able to see that radiation, the universe cannot be expanding at greater than the velocity of light. Yeah, do you have a question?
It might be interesting to explain what thermal conductivity is and why it cannot exist without inflation, or maybe it can, but why inflation is important to thermal conductivity.
Well, thermal connectivity means that every part of the universe is thermodynamically connected with every other part of the universe. And if the universe expands too quickly from the cosmic creation event, or pardon me, too slowly from the cosmic creation event, that won't happen. And so what inflation does is that it guarantees that every part of the universe is thermally connected. And without inflation, you're going to have parts of the universe that are so far away. You know, given the size of the universe, if inflation didn't happen, then the most distant parts of the universe cannot be thermally connected to our part of the universe. Now, why is that important for life? That's important for life because what that does is sustain homogeneity and isotropy on very large scales of the universe, which means you're not going to have parts of the universe that are extremely dense where the rest of the universe is virtually empty. And that would be catastrophic to life. It's important that we have a fairly even distribution of galaxies and clusters of galaxies, but not too even. It's one of the fine-tuning arguments. It needs to be roughly isotropic, but not perfectly isotropic. After all, if it was perfectly isotropic, there wouldn't be any galaxies at all. But if it's too isotropic, or pardon me, if it's not isotropic enough, then you just get all the mass kind of clumping in to huge black holes. You basically get black holes and neutron stars and nothing else. So you want galaxy stars and planets so that life is possible. You need to fine-tune the isotropy and the homogeneity, which means the inflation event has to be fine-tuned. So you don't want the inflation to be too efficient or not efficient enough. Because those are the two conditions. You've got to have the universe thermally connected, and we've got to have isotropy and homogeneity on large scales. And basically, that's what this map tells us. So as you look at this, on a very large scale, it is roughly homogeneous. Because what we're actually measuring here is the temperature of the universe when light first separates from darkness. And the temperature comes in at 2.75 degrees above absolute zero. Now, these temperature fluctuations we're observing, they're coming in at about the 10 to 100 microkelvin level. So, you know, it looks like this is, you know, really bright and really cold, but the truth is the difference between this place and this place over here is only a few hundred microkelvins. So these are basically temperature differences of about one part in 10,000. So because it's only one part in 10,000, that tells us that the universe is extraordinarily isotropic and homogeneous. Otherwise, we get bigger temperature differences.
In Fahrenheit, what's the delta?
In Fahrenheit, let's see, that's minus 452 degrees, 452 degrees below zero. And the Fahrenheit is the temperature of the universe at this point.
The delta in Fahrenheit?
What's the delta in Fahrenheit? Well, it'd be a 10,000th of a degree. So that's the temperature differences we're looking at, which is why it took these sophisticated instruments. For example, my peers have been looking at the cosmic background radiation ever since early 1960s. But for a period of 30 years, we could not see the temperature differences because the temperature differences were so incredibly tiny. And so, yeah, when you look at these maps, they exaggerate the temperature differences so you can see them. The truth is, there's very little difference at all. Oh, and by the way, the last factor here determines whether or not dark energy is a constant or a variable. If this number equals minus 1.0, then it's a constant, which we refer to as Einstein's cosmological constant. And the data seems to be suggesting that indeed dark energy is described by a single constant, not multiple constants. So this got published literally just days ago, the 9-year WMAT. You can Google it and see all the other stuff. But a few weeks ago, to complement this, was the first data release of the Planck satellite. And this is what it looks like. So look at how much more detail you see here. This is put up by a coalition of the European nations. The United States actually has a toe in this as well. And this is 15 months of data. So the previous one was 9 years worth with the WMAP. And this is 15 months worth with the Planck satellite. So you can see that there's a lot of expectation this Planck satellite is going to deliver us some really outstanding results. But hey, like scientists are typically do, they say, we're going to show you what's happening right in the ground floor. This is the first release, and much better ones are coming. Yes. Okay, this is a picture of the universe when it's only...
At the grapefruit point?
Okay, this is when the universe is only 375,000 years. Not at the grapefruit point.
Oh.
The grapefruit point is 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the cosmic creation event.
Okay.
However, when the universe is created, it's created nearly infinitely hot. And when it's nearly infinitely hot, you can't see distinguishing features in terms of the massive spots of the universe, because the universe is so hot at that point that all you've got is a plasma. And with a plasma, the temperature is going to be the same everywhere. There will be no temperature differences. You only get temperature differences when the universe expands enough that you begin to have atoms. Now, the difference between a plasma and atoms, with atoms, you've got electrons that are orbiting the nuclei of the atoms. In a plasma, the universe is so hot that none of the electrons can be captured into orbits about the nuclei. So you've got naked nuclei and all these unattached electrons just flowing everywhere in the universe. And that's the status of the universe until the universe reaches an age of 375,000 years. When it hits 375,000 years, that's the first time that the universe is cool enough for atoms to form. Now, once atoms form, then we astronomers can see the differences between the hot spots and the cold spots in the universe. Or, to kind of borrow a phrase from Genesis 1, that's when we first see a distinction between light and dark. That's when you get a separation between darkness and light. So this is the earliest time in the history of the universe that by direct observations, we can get any information. We can look earlier. What's the black background? Okay, this is what's called a whole sky map. So it's 360 degrees from here to here. And so you're basically looking at the entire sky and looking at the universe everywhere. Now, what's also a project going on to complement this, there's a project called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Sloan is a private foundation, and they've funded literally a 30-year project to map in detail the positions of galaxies and clusters of galaxies. Now, why are they doing that? Because Big Bang cosmology predicts that every one of these orange and red spots will become a future cluster of galaxies. And so the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is designed to see whether or not the positions of galaxies and clusters of galaxies that exist today actually match in position, correspond, and they do. So it's another great way to test the Big Bang creation model. Now, this Planck map is going to allow us to make a very detailed comparison with a Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And that actually gives us a lot of insight into dark energy. Because with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, you're measuring the universe much later in history than you are here. It's also a great way to determine the makeup of what's called exotic dark matter. Because the universe, let me give you the numbers here. What this is telling us is that dark energy makes up 68.5% of the total stuff of the universe, which means the mass of the universe makes up 31.5%. However, the same map was also able to measure how much of that mass is made up of protons, electrons, and protons. It comes in at a little bit less than 4.7%, which means the rest of that 31.5% must be exotic matter, made up of particles that, unlike protons, neutrons, and electrons, do not strongly interact with light. You can see why astronomers are so excited about this. They're getting information about the universe that you really can't get any other way. And what I want you to see here is just, we now know that the universe is exceptionally flat, literally flat, to better than 1% precision. And notice we got a little better measurement of the scalar spectral index with much smaller, smaller error bars. And here we got a determination that tells us that the certainty with which we now know that the universe has an inflationary event is not just 99.99%, it's 99.9999%, because the error bar here is smaller, and we also got a number a little bit closer to 0.95. But the real interest amongst astronomers is whether or not we can measure this number to, say, 5 or 6 places a decimal. If we can do that, then we'll know exactly what kind of inflation. I'm excited about it as the president of Reasons to Believe, because if we can nail down exactly what kind of inflation is responsible for the universe in which we live and what kind of geometry is responsible for the universe in which we live, it's going to give us, in my opinion, a phenomenal amount of new evidence for superintelligent, supernatural design. But that's a wait and see. It's probably going to take another 6 years of data collection from the Planck satellite before we know these numbers with the certainty that we'd like to know them. Yes? Well, inflation refers to the extremely brief period in which the universe hyper-expanded. It's always been expanding. But for most of the history of the universe, it's been expanding at a little bit less than the velocity of light. But during the inflationary period, it was expanding literally thousands, if not millions of times, faster than the velocity of light. And that's actually one of the goals of being able to measure this number, is figure out exactly what was going on during the inflationary event. Now, if I can go back to this map, it's actually showing that the anomaly that we found in the W map has been confirmed. It's showing that we do have a spot that seems to be a little colder than what you'd predict if the universe indeed were homogeneous and isotropic across the entire map, and likewise you've got this hot spot. On the other hand, it's not quite as dramatic as what the W map showed, but it is more definitive in showing, yes, it really does look like that this would be an anomaly for simple inflation. So it is more evidence that indeed we're looking at one of the more complex inflationary models, a model that probably is going to show us a design that we don't see right now. And likewise, we got a measure that shows that it looks like we're looking at a cosmological constant for the dark energy. Now, that was Planck, and that was WMAP, all published in the last 6 weeks. WMAP 6 weeks ago, WMAP just days ago, Planck just 6 weeks ago, and literally just in the last issue, the Astrophysical Journal, is where they measured the distance to this galaxy with high precision. Now, the galaxy is so far away that that's the best photo image we have of the galaxy. But what it did is show that the Hubble constant is 68.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And that translates into an age of the universe of 13.79 plus or minus 1.3. Now, here are the three figures. And this is what I think has got astronomers so excited, is that for the first time, we got high agreement between the best measurements for the expansion rate of the universe and the one that is free of all possible systematic effects. So notice that the middle one has a large error bar, but is totally free of systematic effects, compared with the two that are the most precise, where there's still some uncertainty about the systematic effects. But one reason why they put the Planck satellite up, it's a different instrument than the WMAP. And so you're going to have different instrumental issues with Planck than you will the WMAP. And so it was designed to try to eliminate the systematic or instrumental effects. Notice how closely they agree. I mean, very close. And then you've got the one that has no assumptions built into it, sandwiched right in between. And what's fun is, well, we're not going to get a better answer from the WMAP. They're basically shutting down the experiment. They said 9 years is enough, and you're going for another few more years isn't going to make a significantly better answer. All the hope is on the Planck satellite and also on the very long baseline array, because both of those instruments are going to be producing significantly better results in the next 3 to 5 years. So it's wait and see, but already it's looking really exciting. Okay, I saw your hand was up first.
Do if these measurements of the age of the universe are assumption-free and direct measurements, isn't it fair to say that this alone pretty much kills young Earth creation?
It does. It definitely does. This middle one does. These two top ones, they can say instrumental effects. However, what makes that challenge difficult, it's two different instruments essentially giving the same answer. And these are high precision instruments above the Earth's atmosphere. I mean, there's really not much in the way of systematic effects that you can attack in either of these instruments. And so you've got two different ones. But the middle one, you really can't assail at all. And hey, the error bar is at the 10% level, but hey, give them a few more years. They're claiming they can get the answer down to about 1% precision.
But the only argument they're really left with is an appearance of age argument.
Yes.
Correct?
That's really the only, and you know, they really don't want to go there. So, yes.
Young Earth creationists, where do they stand when it comes to the age of the universe?
They think the universe is less than 10,000 years old. Whereas this is showing us that the universe is 13.8 billion years old. I mean, if I can go back here, you've got 13.81 with the Planck. And if we go back to the WMAP, they're saying 13.77. In both cases, the error bar is about, plus or minus 0.06 billion. So they certainly agree within the error bars. And hey, if you put the two together, I'm saying 13.80, which is exciting, because until these two results were published, we only had answers that were good to three places of the decimal. We're now getting to the fourth place of the decimal, 13.80 instead of just 13.7 or 13.8.
You got 5 minutes.
I got 5 minutes left? Oh, boy. Time was wrong. Well, you know, I've been doing a lot of talking, so I will take more questions. You were next, and you had a question. There's two over here. Go ahead.
Do the young universe proponents more or less agree that the universe has been expanding from one central focal point at the beginning?
They do.
They acknowledge that.
Well, because that's in the Bible. And it's also in the Bible that the universe expands. Now, I have heard one reaction to this. When this was published 6 weeks ago, they were claiming that this age of the universe, T naught, was discordant with the best WMAP measurements. And that's because this 7-year data release came up with a number of 13.75. Okay, so they said 13.75, 13.81, error bar 0.05. They were claiming that this was discordant. However, when the WMAP came out, let me pull you back here to the WMAP 9-year release. Instead of saying 13.75, it's 13.77. If you go back to the first year data release, they were saying 13.72. The 3-year data release said 13.73. 7 year 13.75, now it's 13.77. Now what's been going on is that with the accumulation of more data, they've been able to lower the error bar. But yeah, young Earth creations have always been saying, hey look, the number seems to be slowly going up. Yeah, but it's going up very slowly. And well within reason, given the noise that we see in trying to measure the cold spots and hot spots with high precision.
So they acknowledge that the expansion of the universe has proceeded from one central point at the beginning.
That there is a space-time beginning. Universe expands from that space-time beginning.
The central point is going up.
They don't. However, I mean, the latest rebuttal coming up from young Earth creationists is to say the velocity of light is not necessarily 300,000 kilometers per second in all directions. What they're now claiming is that the velocity of light as it approaches Earth is infinite, and as it goes away from Earth is half, it's 150,000 kilometers per second. Well, what they're picking up on, and you'll see this on both the ICR and Answers in Genesis website, it's due to Jason Lyle. And I'm going to have to debate him that October, so this will probably come up.
Oh, joy.
But what he's pointing out is something that is correct, that when we measure the velocity of light in the laboratory, or when we bounce light off of a reflector on the moon or Venus or whatever, that we're measuring the return path of the velocity of light. We cannot measure the one-way velocity of light. We can only measure the two-way velocity of light. So he says, given that we can only measure the two-way velocity of light, we're free to speculate that when it goes one direction, it's at an infinite velocity. When it goes in the opposite direction, it goes half the velocity that we measure in the lab.
How does he deal with E equals MC squared? You change the speed of light, you just screw up E and M like crazy.
Well, the real problem, however, is that it is simply a convention that we assume that the velocity of light is the same backwards and forwards. That is a convention in physics and astronomy. That assumption pervades all of physics and astronomy. But Jason Lyle is right. We have no way of proving that the velocity is the same in both directions. But where he is stuck is that in order to maintain his young Earth model, it's got to be at an infinite velocity everywhere in the universe towards planet Earth. But directionality is not a convention. That's not something that's free to speculate on. If you're going to say that the velocity of light is infinite in all directions targeting planet Earth, that in effect, according to relativity, generates a gravitational field. Which means you would not only see a gravitational field because of the mass of planet Earth, you would see a second gravitational field because of the fact that the light is infinite in all directions towards planet Earth. In other words, Earth becomes the focal point. So that's the fundamental flaw in the model. And I'm out of time. So we'll take up the questions next time. Next time we're going to dive into the lesson. So, and I didn't get to tell you about this third paper too, which is actually a proof of when the universe has dark energy transitioning the universe from slowing down on its expansion to speeding up. Because when the universe... Okay, dark energy is the energy embedded in the space surface of the universe. And as that surface gets larger and larger as the universe expands, dark energy becomes more and more powerful in its capacity to accelerate the universe. Now, gravity works the opposite. So the mass of the universe works to slow down the expansion of the universe. I'm sure you all remember this from your junior high physics class. If you've got two massive bodies, they attract one another under the influence of gravity. And the closer they are together, the more powerfully they attract. What does that tell you? When the universe is young, the bits and pieces of matter are close together. And therefore, gravity will be more powerful to slow down the expansion of the universe when it's young than when it's older. Because when it's older, the mass of bodies become farther apart. But dark energy works the opposite. It's weak when the universe is young. It's powerful when the universe is old. And what this paper has done, they have actually been able to measure with high precision when the transition took place between slowing down and speeding up. The answer is it happened 7.25 billion years ago. So 7.25 billion years ago was a great transition event, as astronomers refer to it. Now, that transition event is crucial for determining whether you get planets that can have advanced life. So if all you want is bacteria, you can kind of slop around a little bit with that transition time. But if you want advanced life, that has to be fine-tuned. So that's the next project, is to actually determine the fine-tuning in that number. But hey, an exciting week. You can imagine why we get so thrilled when the Astrophysical Journal arrives at our office.
You sleep that night?
Well, the problem is we get 8 of those issues a month, so it gives us 8 times to get really excited when the journals arrive. But I'm out of time. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you for our privilege of being alive in the 21st century. We're seeing all these amazing instruments making these dramatic measurements of things that until now we could only speculate about. Thank you, Lord, that we live at a time when the evidence for your glory revealed in the heavens is so dramatic and so powerful and so specific in pointing out that you're the one that's responsible for everything we see. Father in heaven, as we bask in what you have created, I pray that you would deliver us from worshiping the creation and instead worship you.
Yes.
Let us recognize, Lord, that you're the one that made all this possible. And thank you, Lord, for making it so beautiful and so elegant that we could actually enjoy what you've done to such a great level. In Jesus' name, amen.